This is Berkshire Grown's podcast series for farmers. My name is Andrea Calori. I am a program manager at Berkshire Grown, a nonprofit located in the Berkshires with the mission to support and promote local agriculture as a vital part of our region's community, economy, and landscape. This podcast series is an opportunity for farmers to hear from other farmers about what they're doing and how they're doing it. And it's also a way to share stories and learn from each other. Today, I am with Winton Pitkoff, director of the Massachusetts Food System Collaborative. Welcome, Winton.
Hi, Andrew.
Winton, to start, can you just tell me a little bit about the work of the Massachusetts Food System Collaborative?
Sure. A little bit of history. So about 7 or 8 years ago, the state of Massachusetts realized that it was starting to deal with a lot of questions related to food and didn't have a context into which to place them all and consider them all. And so decided it was time for a statewide food system plan to be developed. And this wasn't the first time the idea came up in the state. We'd actually done one in the early 70s during the food pricing crisis then. But so the state contracted out with a group of folks to develop a food system plan, and I was part of the team that did that. It was a two-year process, a deep engagement process that involved about 1,500 people, ranging from individual farmers to representatives of big organizations representing lots of people, and really delving into all of the issues around the local food system, from land to soil health, to inputs like energy and pollinators, to actual production of food for both farms and fisheries, to processing and distribution and marketing, as well as public health issues like food waste and everything in between. And so the plan was completed at the end of 2015. And a group of folks who've been very involved in the process really wanted to make sure it was that it had some legs to it, that it wasn't something that just sat on a shelf as a set of proposals. So formed the Massachusetts Food System Collaborative to promote, monitor, and facilitate implementation of the plan. Now, the plan is a giant set of recommendations ranging from very broad aspirational things to very small targeted policy recommendations. And it's too big for any one organization or entity to take on, but the collaborative said we want to organize people and build their capacity to work at the policy level to make these things happen. Hmm. And so in the 4 years since, we've taken the lead on a number of projects. The first thing we worked on was something called the Working Group on Agriculture and Public Health to try to resolve some of the tensions between protecting public health at the municipal level, which is the role of local boards of health and health agents, as well as the to sort of resolve the tension between there and farmers' needs to maintain sustainable businesses. So that was a project that we started right out of the gate and is still ongoing. We've taken the lead on a lot of issues around food waste in the state, diverting edible food waste to families that need food, as well as inedible food waste to composting and anaerobic digesters to try to reduce the amount of food that gets landfilled each year. We have been leading the campaign for HIP funding, which supports the Healthy Incentives Program, which is a SNAP doubling program at farmers markets that supports both low-income families as well as local farms. We helped urge the legislature to start the first in the nation local food system caucus, which is a bipartisan bicameral caucus in the State House. For legislators to talk about food issues in a really comprehensive way. It's already the second largest caucus in the State House, second only to the Democratic Party caucus. And what we're in the midst of right now is a priority setting project. The plan is almost 5 years old. It was very much a snapshot in time. A lot of it is still absolutely relevant, but it's a chance to take a look in light of the crisis that we're going through right now to bring people back together and talk about, are there things in the plan that we really should re-emphasize given what we've learned from this crisis, or are there things that we've learned from this crisis that indicate we need to be thinking about something entirely different and entirely new? Mm. So we're just starting that series of conversations now.
Yeah, that actually, you know, that's great because it's leading into my next question, if you can speak a little bit to how the pandemic crisis has really affected the local food system here in Massachusetts.
Yeah, well, I mean, the crisis has affected everything, and it certainly has affected food broadly, in that most people weren't aware of or certainly didn't talk about the food supply chain prior to just a few months ago, and suddenly it became very relevant to everybody as they started seeing their favorite products run out in grocery stores. And so, you know, there's been with everything from big national companies to smaller local producers, a real scramble to figure out how to adapt to this situation. For some, it's been very challenging, and for some, I mean, for everyone, it's been very challenging. But some have been better able to adapt and recognize need in their communities and figure out how they can best serve that need. And so we've seen some really tremendous efforts here in Western Mass from farms that are stepping up and doing more delivery services, recognizing that farmers markets have been challenged by this, both in terms of customers getting used to staying home as opposed to going to multiple places to shop. And as also concerns from local boards of health, and some of them giving farmers markets a little bit of a hard time about operating. And so farms have really shifted to doing deliveries, and not just individual farms, but collectives of farms selling everything from produce to dairy to processed foods, and delivering it all over the state. So that's been a really interesting development to see. Lots of things on related to distribution of food to families in need. The state applied for and got a waiver early on that even though schools were shut down, the school cafeterias could still produce meals and make them available to school children and their families. And so there's 1,600 sites and drop-off spots around the state now as school cafeterias continue to operate and make meals for families that need them. In the eastern part of the state, groups like Commonwealth Kitchen are doing really interesting and creative work as a way of both keeping people employed and keeping people fed, leveraging restaurants that are currently idle because of the shutdown, but getting those restaurants to reopen and re-employ people to make meals that are then delivered or made available to frontline workers or to families that are dealing with food insecurity, either that have been for a long time or that are newly dealing with it as a result of layoffs. Groups like Food for Free, that's a food recovery organization that does a lot of rescue of food that would otherwise end up in the waste stream. They're also preparing meals and food boxes and actually distributing them door to door in Cambridge. So a lot of really creative things like that are coming out of this crisis that's really challenged everybody's business model. That, you know, if you had tried to predict what crisis was going to be coming down the line that was going to affect how farms or processors get food to people, this is probably the last thing that people would have considered as something to figure out in advance. So it's pretty amazing how quickly people in all these food businesses and institutions have adjusted to the situation.
I agree. I think that it's been fascinating to watch how farmers and food workers in general have pivoted significantly, changing their sales models, finding new platforms and ways to get food to folks. And also the other thing that I've noticed too, you know, there's this, especially out here in Western Massachusetts, I think we see it quite a bit. There's this interest from the public to start growing their own food as well, whether it's in suburban landscapes, urban landscapes, or in rural landscapes. There's this tremendous demand for things like even like plant starts. And so I'm starting to even see farms shift their business plan and business model for what they're growing to really growing more vegetable starts as opposed to produce to sort of encourage folks to purchase and start their own gardens. It's just been an interesting shift overall in terms of, as you mentioned before, the food supply chain. Where is our food coming from? And food security, you know, making sure that we have it. It's an interesting point in time.
Absolutely. And it's not just produce that people are picking up on. There's also a run on chicks, people wanting to make produce their own eggs, as well as piglets. And it's great to see people getting interested in that. The concern obviously is what happens when people do have to go back to work, and hoping that that this is a long-term commitment on the part of individuals who are looking to raise more of their own food.
Correct. And I think I wonder if we might see a little bit more of the educational piece to follow soon with the responsibility that comes with producing your own food and raising livestock, and also just what role farmers play in that, and that entire concept of helping folks understand where their food is coming from and how to grow it. But I also think it's going to lead to a deeper appreciation of the work that our agricultural workers are doing, as people begin to see like the challenges that come with, you know, raising livestock, or the challenges that come with producing your own vegetables. I think it will really instill a deeper gratitude for that work.
I think that's right. I think it's connecting people with the food supply a little bit more deeply, and making them more aware and more thoughtful about the choices they make with their food.
Agreed. More intentional. Absolutely. It's funny you mentioned the chicks, just because I was at the farmer co-op yesterday, because I get ducklings every year, and I needed to get the chick feeder and chick waterer. I didn't have one anymore. And I called a couple of places before I went there, and everyone kept saying they were all out, but the demand was so high. It's unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it. It's impressive.
Yeah.
I'd love you to speak a little bit about some of the challenges that farmers are now facing, and also the challenges that our infrastructure is facing in terms of the local food system due to this pandemic crisis.
Sure. I mean, there's a few things, and I would say that a lot of it's not due to the pandemic. A lot of it has been underscored by the pandemic, but the challenges have always been there. And so one thing that I think underlies all of this is the cost of food issue, so much of our food comes from an industrialized food system that has tremendous unrealized external costs, primarily around pollution, also around labor issues, that artificially deflates prices of food. And that food right now in America is less expensive than anywhere in the world ever in history as a percent of income for people. And so what that means is that local producers have to compete with those prices of the food that's at the industrials, that's produced on the industrial by the industrial system, and so have to sell their food at similar prices. But local producers deal with much higher costs. More labor is more expensive in Massachusetts. Land prices, energy, all these things are more expensive in Massachusetts. Plus, we have a more challenging climate to deal with in Massachusetts, and so that's a real issue. The flip side of the cost issue is that even though prices are low, we still have quite a lot of people going hungry. And so there's some real disconnect there between the realities of production and the demands on the consumption side. And there's an irony in that the food system workers are eligible for SNAP and other food subsidy programs at a higher rate than any other industry. So the people that are producing our food, that are serving it and distributing it, can't afford it. And so that's something that's a challenge for the broader food system as well as the local food system. As far as infrastructure goes, I think, you know, one of the issues that comes up when we talk about supply chain has to do with just basic issues around storage and particularly around refrigeration. The food system is very much geared towards just-in-time production and just-in-time distribution. Grocery stores rarely have more food on the shelves and in the storeroom than they're going to sell in the next 2 or 3 days. That's what's caused some of the runs on food and the empty shelves. is that the food's just not available immediately as people ramped up the demand because all the restaurants closed and people were suddenly eating at home much more. So some of that infrastructure has to be dealt with here as well. On a production side, land access continues to be an issue. The price of land that I mentioned already is extremely high in Massachusetts. And so there's pressures for farmers to sell to developers and for land to be lost to farming. There's also pressures on the other side of the equation where the state continues to buy up land for conservation and doesn't allow agriculture, doesn't allow food to be grown on that property. Yeah. So all of that makes the land that we do have for farming more and more precious. And then obviously the inconsistencies of the growing season brought about by climate change. The need for more controlled climate growing so that there's consistency for production, because that's what the market demands. And controlled climate growing is obviously more expensive and more energy intensive. So those are some of them. There's a lot more challenges than that, but those are the big ones that come to mind most immediately.
Yeah, the access to land is something that in a previous conversation with another farmer was a significant challenge and hurdle for him. But the option to lease was something that he was able to use and has been really successful with, leasing land as a way to, as a first generation farmer, as a way to farm. But yeah, I can see like in the state, even in terms of conservation, it is a challenge because the land that ends up being conserved doesn't allow for any agricultural production.
Right.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about some of the work that you guys are doing in regards to climate change and the future of agriculture in the state?
Yeah, the state has been somewhat forward thinking around climate change in the statements that have been made by state leaders as far as their interest in getting to be a carbon neutral state, and they have made some investments in that direction. Obviously, that was all before the crisis, and we're going to have to see what happens as the fiscal situation of the state shifts to recovery. But that they've not actively considered agriculture in all of their climate change discussions. And so not just the role that agriculture has to play in helping to mitigate climate change, and there certainly is quite a bit of that, but also in the impacts of climate change on what we're able to produce here in Massachusetts. And so one of the things that we do is try to make sure that they are considering the food system in all of this. There are some programs, some grant programs that are administered by the Department of Ag Resources that are explicitly for helping farmers either shift to renewable energy or do other things that are related to carbon sequestration or things like that ultimately mitigate or help them adapt to the impacts of climate change. Those programs are great. They're also tremendously oversubscribed and they need more money if they're going to meet the demands that are out there. I think the state's taken some steps in the right direction. We just need to continue to keep pressure on them to really recognize the role agriculture plays in climate change.
Obviously all of the agricultural businesses will be affected by climate change just in terms of, the growing season, what can be produced and what cannot. But are there any particular industries you can think of that would be the most impacted by climate change in the state?
I mean, we see it all over. Obviously, the more tender and sensitive foods that are grown are more susceptible to a mid-season hailstorm or a long period of no rain. There's only so much that you can do in climate-controlled growing. And it's also not just the weather. It's also things like the changing invasives
that you know weren't able to survive here before, and that as the climate changes, they are. And so, for instance, the Asian longhorn beetles and the risk that they pose to maple syrup production. And the others that are really being impacted by this are the fisheries. That as the temperatures of the oceans change, that affects what seafood is available where, and that you know it takes longer for markets to change, unfortunately, than it does for those the species propagations to change, and so it's very hard on fisheries as well. So those are the primary impacts, and it's not simply about it just getting warmer. Although we know that collectively overall it is, it's that it's inconsistent, and that some years the growing season really starts out early because winter goes away earlier. But often what's more likely to happen is a real choppy start to the growing season where it gets warm and then cold again and then warm and then cold again. And so we've seen a real damaging impact on fruit growers as buds start to set or as trees actually blossom, and then a late frost happens. That can really mean, you know, no peaches for a year.
Right. A couple years ago, that was something that happened with peaches. And then even this year, we've seen, you know, we didn't get any blossoms early or we didn't get the late frost, but we definitely had that inconsistent weather pattern where it was warm and then got really cold and then has warmed up again. And also more precipitation in the winter too. And not in terms of snowfall, but rather rain, which has been a new thing.
Yep. And that impacts soil health, and it's all very, very connected to each other. Yep.
Can you speak a little bit about, you know, how you see the landscape of the local food system in Massachusetts in the future as it evolves?
I think there's a number of key elements here, and I think that the state really needs to make some commitments around, what do we want to see as far as the amount of food produced in Massachusetts being consumed in Massachusetts. I think, you know, we've established some good overall goals and made some good recommendations about how to strengthen the food system broadly. But I think it's worth it to develop some real concrete goals and figure out how we're gonna work towards them. You know, the state has done some excellent work in other industries around education or medicine, of how they really want to build those industries. And I think this crisis is really making folks aware of how important the food system is. It's 1 in 10 workers in the state. It's a full 5% of the state's gross product. And when you have these disruptions like this, that food system needs to be resilient. And the only way to make the kind of commitment to building that resilience is to set some real honest goals about what do we really want to produce? What are we well equipped to produce here? How do we get to that point? The next crisis is not going to look like this crisis where, you know, the idea of saying, oh, we have to be prepared for, you know, restaurants being shut down and institutional food systems being shut down. That just happens to be what this situation is, but the next crisis is going to be different. It's going to be a 3-year drought, or it's going to be an interruption of the power grid or some other sort of fuel shortage. And so it's not about having the tools in place to respond to particular scenarios. It's about having a really robust, well-integrated food system that supports both the producers and the growers as well as the consumers. And so it's going to take some real concentrated public sector attention to this. I think more growing in urban areas is important. We're never going to grow enough food in the cities for people to feed themselves. But I think, again, that connection to the food system is really important in that it then encourages those folks to buy more local food and support the farmers. But everything that we do to increase the purchases, to increase demand on the local food system, has to be matched with increased support for more production at the local food system, because as I talked about earlier, Massachusetts growers are really at a disadvantage when it comes to competing in the larger food system.
Yeah, I think, you know, you bring up a good point about the importance of strengthening and creating a much more resilient local food economy. You know, that's one thing that I'm seeing right now is that consumers are, you know, they're afraid about going to a larger supermarket. They don't know where their food is coming from, and they're looking to start to source much closer to home. And so if we had that infrastructure already in place that was strong and could meet that demand, and if the demand is there, then I think it avoids what we're experiencing now. You know, you had mentioned earlier that it's not so much that these challenges that have come up are a result of the pandemic crisis, but rather it just shows where the weak links were in the infrastructure and how those need to change. But I do think, you know, just observing what's going on, at least here in this side of the state, you know, it's incredible how quickly folks have adapted and are trying to get food out there. You know, you had mentioned some of the collectives that have formed. You know, I can think of a couple right now as well, of farms grouping together and trying to get food to folks. But also this change of the farm becoming the grocery store is interesting and new as well. I think a lot of farmers are surprised by doing that, by making the farm stand or the farm store. All of a sudden they're bringing in product or value added product from elsewhere so that people can do all of their shopping through the farm, as opposed to going to a larger store elsewhere where they're not sure of where their food's coming from. And so that goes back to this piece that you had mentioned, and I agree with you about education and outreach and just, you know, public outreach and ensuring that folks are aware of what Massachusetts growers are doing and where their food is coming from and the value of that. You know, I'd be curious to see more programming or more incentives around that in order to just strengthen those connections and those links, right?
Yeah, it's, you know, the whatever shift has happened in the last 3 months can't yet be considered a cultural shift. It's a response to an emergency. And so the farms that are investing in those kinds of connections and in beefing up their stores, it remains to be seen whether consumers are going to continue or are going to return to, you know, what they see as more convenient when the crisis lifts and they're back shopping at grocery stores. You know, it's diversification always, I don't want to say always, diversification can often be a solution. The reality though is that most farms in the state are not where the eaters are. The eaters are in the cities. And so, you know, for those folks, they're not going to be traveling to farm stands or to the newly built out farm stores. And so I think the distribution models, the delivery models are what's going to be more effective in the cities. That's costly though. You know, fuel prices are low right now, but they're going to go back up. And as we said, it's already hard to compete with the price of imported tomatoes in a big grocery store. If you start adding to that the costs of delivery, are folks really going to stay with it? So I think, you know, farmers have to have a range of ways that they distribute what they produce, because as we've seen from this crisis, if you're selling just for the institutional market, that didn't work out well for farmers that had all their eggs in that particular basket this time around. And you know, if you're selling solely to consumers or solely through a delivery model, there may be a crisis that impacts that and that makes you have to shift altogether, all over again. And so I think having multiple ways of getting your food and your products to people is really the safest bet.
Yeah, and I think that also speaks to, you know, now as farmers are in the growing season and starting to go to market or doing retail, you know, the question is starting to come up, at least for me in thinking about this, how are they going to plan for the next season? What are they taking away from this season? And obviously, yes, it's a response to this crisis, but also I think it's highlighting some things that maybe had not been thought of before, or new sales strategies that have not been thought of before. Just what will be the planning process going forward for the next growing season? And I don't have the answer for that, but I think that that's something that folks are going to be starting to think about more and more in terms of diversification of where their food is going and how they're selling it. It's going to be at the forefront.
Yeah, market assurance is critical for farmers. You know, it's not a factory that can see that sales have dropped and so they can slow down production today and be ready to ramp up again tomorrow. Farmers are planting right now for the food that they, you know, that they think they're going to be able to sell in 3 or 4 months. Yeah. If there's a lack of assuredness, where they're not able to see potential for sales, it's better for them to actually not plant and to leave some fields fallow and so ultimately produce less food, because it costs them money if they grow food that they then can't turn around and sell. It's not, you know, most of what they're growing can't be stored over the long term. You know, that speaks to then in turn of how can we have processing facilities that can meet that demand so that they can turn what's grown in Massachusetts into shelf stable products. Mm-hmm. And so if a farm does grow 10 acres of tomatoes without being sure of where the market is, they know that at the very least someone's ready to buy it and turn it into canned tomatoes or sauce or something like that. You know, that works for some things and not for others, obviously. If it's a product that can be flash frozen or that can be stored in some other way or converted to shelf stable, processing really becomes an important part of figuring out how to keep farms sustainable.
It's actually something I haven't really thought of. It's true. Just so, you know, sort of what happens to that food that isn't, like, you know, where can it go and be processed and turned to something shelf stable?
Yeah, and for most foods, there really are some good ways. I mean, lettuce doesn't store well, but a lot of other products really can. And so, but we don't have a lot of really scalable processing infrastructure in the state that on a moment's notice can say, oh, you've got, you know, 5 tons of peaches that are about to spoil. We can flash freeze those, or we can turn those into preserves. Right. And that then you don't have to worry about the immediate market for it. And we're seeing that right now with the fisheries as well, is that, you know, particularly shellfish, they lost sales to the tune of 100%, you know, that so much of the shellfish is sold to the restaurant industry, and the restaurants all closed. And so they're not even sending boats out anymore, because there's no place to sell scallops and oysters and clams. And so, how do we figure out ways to buffer crises like this for industries like that?
So, just for my last question here before we finish our conversation, this just made me think a little bit about sort of the CSA model, and I mean, obviously, that's a much smaller scale to sort of help farmers have some insurance before the growing season. Do you see or even foresee a boom in that? Because I know, like, the last couple of years, maybe the last 10 years, I've noticed a decline in CSA participation as farms are starting to open farm stores. It's kind of like what happened, I think, even with markets a little bit. Like, I've sort of seen this, it's just interesting, like, there'll be like the markets, people stop going to the markets as much, they do more CSAs, they stop doing the CSAs, and then they start going to the farm store more. Like, there's always this sort of ebb and flow in terms of how consumers are choosing to purchase directly from farms. Do you see the CSA model sort of getting a huge revival and coming back in the next, I mean, I would probably say the next year, just because of what's going on now? And is it a viable model for farmers, I would say, to really think about if they aren't doing it, or to try and, like, capture more consumers to become shareholders in a CSA?
Yeah, I think there's obviously a boom in that right now. And as folks have gone to the grocery store and found they can't get what they want or realize that they don't want to be going out as much, the idea of having food delivered to you is obviously very appealing, and the idea of having food that's fresh is certainly appealing as well. The timing of this is such that the stuff that's in CSA boxes right now tends to be more storage crops and leafy greens and things like that that can grow early. So we're not even into the
full swing.
For my palate, the best part of the CSA season, when you've got tomatoes showing up on your doorstep every week, or you're picking them up every week. But consumers are fickle. And so I think, as they get close to the time of, as we get closer and closer to, sort of whatever normalcy looks like again, people are going to start demanding to have what they want when they want it again. And so, just like I said before, I think the CSA model is going to work for some people, but not for others. And so I would never recommend a farm pivoting entirely to doing all their sales by CSA. But these farms that have formed these collectives and are letting people pick and choose and order, exactly what they want that week, I think that model certainly has some legs. That's just very, very labor intensive, and figuring out how to recover those costs is going to mean making those deliveries and those services commensurately more expensive to cover those costs.
Yeah, I agree. All right, Winton, I want to thank you so much for taking some time today to talk with me about the work that you guys are doing.
Thank you for having me. It's been a good conversation. As with most of us, I think I'm focused on the day-to-day tasks. So having a half hour to step back and think big picture stuff has been helpful for me as well. So thanks for inviting me.
No, I agree. And I think, thank you. It's great. These are some really important ideas and things to be talking about, especially right now. So I'm really happy to have this as a part of our podcast series. I think a lot of folks, both farmers and consumers, are going to be really fascinated and interested in the work that you guys are doing, what's happening at the state level. So thank you again so much. And we'll talk soon.
Excellent. Thank you.